Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent are General Chuck Coletta. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. Nice to meet you. Or nice to see you again.
And General Kevin Lauderdale. Hi, Kevin.
I think we have a wonderful chance to beat Joe Rogan this year.
Oh, God. No. That name should never be uttered on MASHcast, but okay. We'll edit around that. But so anyway, Kevin, Chuck, thank you both for being here. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no. Thank you for having me.
This is going to be great.
Absolutely. We're here to talk about the season six episode Change Day, which is the eighth episode of season six. It originally aired on November 8th, 1977. It was written by the always dependable Lawrence Marks and directed by Don Weiss. So, of course, everybody, you know, Chuck and Kevin have been on the show multiple times, so we don't have to go into the MASH histories. We can get right into the plot of this episode. Colonel Potter gets word that I-Corps is changing the official Army scrip, which is what they use for money instead of actual U.S. currency, and makes the announcement that everyone should get their money ready for the big exchange the following day. Winchester sees this as an opportunity to make a buck or two. He hatches a plan to buy up all the old, soon-to-be-useless scrip from all the Korean villagers, which technically they shouldn't even have in the first place, and exchange it for new scrip. The problem is his plan is close to highway robbery. He's only offering 10 cents on the dollar, keeping the other 90 cents for himself. When Hawkeye and BJ get word of the plot from Winchester's Korean tailor, who he drafts in for help, they hatch a plan to thwart who they call a robber baron who makes house calls. While Winchester is out fleecing the masses, Hawkeye and BJ have a friendly sergeant force Winchester out of his jeep, saying the main road is closed. This makes Winchester have to grab all his money and walk to the 477th. After an hour, he arrives at camp, only to be stopped by Klinger, who is currently trying to scam acting as a by-the-book Navy midshipman, keeping everyone from entering the camp while the scrip exchange is taking place, which is SOP. Winchester, stuck outside with piles of soon-to-be-useless paper, begs Hawkeye and BJ to do the money exchange for him. They agree to it, but only offering him the original 10 cents on the dollar rate that he offered the Korean villagers. Winchester, enraged and frustrated, storms off, his plan to make a killing having gone up in smoke. All right, now, that was the A plot. There's actually two other plots in this episode, which I don't mention in the synopsis. We'll get into it as we go on. There's a Klinger plot and there's a Hawkeye plot. All kind of Klinger thing is related to the money. The other one is, but again, we'll talk about it in a little bit. And again, we'll go through the scene by scene like we normally do. But overall, let's start with you, Chuck. What do you think of this episode?
Well, I think it was a well-produced episode, but honestly, I think it was a little bit of a misfire in the sense that it seemed like this was a Frank Burns plot that they had sort of left over from last year and they were going to use. It didn't seem like the Charles Winchester that I remembered. It was very well done, but I don't remember him being this mercenary and greedy, but maybe they were still trying to find the character.
Kevin, what about you?
Two things. First of all, yeah, I agree. It does seem like something that Frank would have done, but they did a very good job of dressing it up in Charles's clothes, you know, applying his linguistic skills, applying his rationale for doing it, which is, it isn't about the money. It's the scenting the spore of opportunity and chasing it down. So they're using it to flesh out Charles really nicely. Plus, this was a fun episode because we got to see two things we don't usually get to see in episodes of MASH. We all know the concept of, you know, medicine, or it's going to cure, you know, he'll die. He needs an operation or he'll die. Or the paperwork got screwed up. But we don't see money exchange, which is something most people aren't really familiar with in real life. And we don't see applying to West Point, if I can drop a spoiler in there. That's the Klinger B plot. There's two things I love to see dealt with in sitcoms, and that's how sitcom writers deal with food and money. And this is one of those money episodes that really intrigues me. And just for everybody, remember, 1950s money to now, basically add a zero. So Charles's suit is $36, yeah, it's $360. Can I take a minute to talk about Charles? This is my first time talking about Charles. We're going to save that for later, maybe.
You would not be Kevin Lauderdale if you didn't take a minute to talk about the show, Kevin. So go right ahead.
Okay, right. So Charles, this is my first time talking about him. He absolutely fascinates me. It's interesting. When I was younger, you know, I wanted to be hip and funny and, you know, be like, you know, BJ or Trapper and Hawkeye. But as I get older, I'm finding the characters I can most easily relate to are middle-aged blowhards who can back it up. And so it's Charles and the Frasier of, especially Frasier, because he really does know about opera and fine wine. Charles really is a brilliant surgeon who dated Audrey Hepburn. But a lot of people think of Charles as sort of like a one-note joke. He's the pompous ass. But for me, Charles is a tragic figure of almost Shakespearean proportions. He's that insular, never complain, never explain, what we used to call WASP, sort of character you see in a John Cheever story, who just will not open up to his fellow man, but even his comrades in arms, the people he's supposed to be closest to. And by all accounts, David Ogden Stiers was a little bit like that. I remember hearing an interview with Loretta Swit where she would say, you know, I say to David, you know, David, I want to invite you to a party I'm throwing, but I don't have your home phone number. And he said, yes, exactly. And jumping forward to the final episode of MASH, according to Loretta Swit, when Charles gives Margaret the book of poetry, she opens it and looks inside, and we don't see what's written in there. But according to her, it was his home phone number.
Oh.
So once it was all over with, then he felt he could open himself up. What this means is that we only get these tiny little glimpses into Charles's mind. And when they happen, they're both uplifting and heartbreaking. I'm thinking of, I'm just going to talk about a couple, the letters episode where Charles gets a leaf from a girl in New England and he launches into a Proustian remembrance of his childhood. BJ says, what you got there, Charles? He just says, nothing, nothing. And all of this culminates in what I'm just going to say right now is my favorite moment in all of MASH. It's season 11, Run for the Money. You guys know what I'm talking about if you know the show. The final few moments, we find out why Charles is fascinated by this one particular soldier. And he won't talk to the soldier. He won't talk to anybody. He keeps it all inside. He's so insular. And he's heartbreaking, and he's amazing. And David Ogden Stiers, even if some of the scripts were a little iffy, I mean, he embodied Charles from day one. He really nailed it. And if a performance is half written and half how you perform, he got his part down absolutely. Loving Charles. And as I record this, I just listened to the Winchester tapes. It was released, which is one of my favorite episodes from this season as well. Great insight into Charles. Great beginning development of his character. But yeah, this does almost seem like a Frank Burns plot dressed up with some fancier language. But it's still, David Ogden Stiers makes it his own.
First of all, Kevin, only you could mention John Cheever and Joe Rogan within a couple of minutes of each other. Regarding Chuck, your comment about that this feels like a Frank Burns episode, according to the IMDb trivia, which, you know, can be trusted, maybe, this was a Frank Burns script. This was a Frank Burns plot left behind. Although how much of that is true, we don't really know. But I agree with Kevin's assessment that even if that's true, even if it is a Frank Burns plot left over and they transposed it over to season 6, they did, no pun intended, tailor it for Winchester. Because as Kevin just points out, and we've seen and we will see in numerous episodes with Winchester as the seasons go on, it's not the money. He's got money. It's the hunt. It's the win. He doesn't, you know, it's the challenge that he wants, not the money. He doesn't really need the money, although you could argue he's maybe a little more strapped for cash being out here than just like everybody else, because he's got to literally get the money. But yeah, it really more is about the challenge of it, which that is obviously not something they would have done with Frank Burns. Frank Burns was just, we all know why Frank Burns is doing it, because he's a skinflint and he's a terrible person. This show, this episode, I like this episode. Again, we'll get into it. It's very funny. There's a lot of great stuff in it. But I even remember when I was a kid watching it, and it just felt like, as much as I was aware of like the backstage stuff of the show, you know, the themes of it or the, you know, the kind of larger meta sense of it, I remember just thinking, this feels like the most villainous Winchester's ever going to be.
Right.
And because it was early on, they were testing him out. They were like, okay, are we going to turn him into the villain of the show, where we're going to make him, because what he does in this episode is terrible. I mean, it's terrible what he does. And it's like, okay, it's one thing to kind of be officious and be arrogant and be reserved and all those other things. It's another thing to be like a crook and to rob poor people that have, you know, don't have a pot to piss in, colloquially. And here he is doing that. And so I feel like, as much as this episode is good, and I think it's very, again, like I said, it's very funny, I would not want to see Winchester turn into this on the regular. And so I feel like this is the furthest out they went with him in terms of being a villain. And they maybe said, you know what? No, let's give him a little more humanity. And one other thing before I ask you, Chuck, about what you think of Winchester in general, because, of course, this is your first episode with him as well. To Kevin's point about his reserve, we know how much of that was David Ogden Stiers. And I know that story about that he wrote his phone number for the last, you know, for the first time in the book, which is a great story. But I wonder how much of that is simply David Ogden Stiers because he was the new guy in the show. You know, at this point, he's season six. The show's a massive hit. He doesn't want to be the guy that ruins it, you know, even if by accident. He doesn't want to be the guy where they're like, oh, yeah, season six, the show plummeted after that. Nobody wants to be the guy that kills MASH. So I almost wonder how much of that is just simply who David Ogden Stiers was as a person and how much of it was he was the new guy. You know, it's like being a new kid at school. You know, you're only the rare person can show up in a new situation and be totally comfortable. So I wonder if he was like, okay, I'm just going to kind of keep quiet because I don't. You know, I'm a little uncomfortable here. These people have all known each other. So that could be part of it as well. I haven't read that many interviews with David Ogden Stiers. I've seen interviews with him in MASH books, but outside of that, I don't recall seeing him a whole lot. And I would see him in stuff, but not interviews. So I never really got a sense of the man, versus, you know, Alan Alda, who does a lot of interviews, or Loretta Swett, Mike Farrell. But so Chuck, I do want to ask you, what do you think of the Winchester years and the character as an addition to the show?
I think he's an interesting character. And I also think that if they were making MASH today, he probably would not be included. I think they might bring in another nurse, or they might bring in somebody different. The whole thing about being the upper class sort of stiff upper lip guy, that works well, I think. But I'm not sure if that would translate again today, because in the Army, everybody is treated the same. And I always had a soft spot for Frank Burns. So my era of MASH is the Frank Burns era. I think in these first few episodes, which I've been watching along with you, you can see that they're not quite sure where the character is going to go. He's sort of antagonistic, but he can stand up to Hawkeye and BJ much more so than Frank ever did. He puts the snake in the bed in one of the very first episodes.
Right.
You know, so Frank would never have the guts to do that, but he's an interesting character. I wish, like you said, that we got a little bit more of him. He was always sort of the most reserved character, and that's kind of hard to deal with on a sitcom where you've got Jamie Farr running around in an evening gown to get some attention.
That said, my favorite character pairing is Charles and Klinger. Anytime those two are together, it's absolute magic.
I do love them as a comedy pair because Klinger, part of it is, again, the natural chemistry, I think, that Jamie Farr had with David Ogden Stiers, but also that Klinger is not intimidated by Charles's attitude. You know, he is who he is and he doesn't worry about it. And Charles lords it over Klinger, and to Klinger, it just bounces off him. He doesn't care. And that's very pleasurable to watch. You know, there's the only way you let someone upset you, you know, it's up to you. So someone can throw as much at you, but if you just let it bounce off you, there's nothing they can do. And so I always like that. I like that Klinger has always just been like, yeah, I'm a street guy from Toledo. I'm not part of the upper crust from Massachusetts, and I don't care. You know, right. I think that was great to watch. And I think there's a reason why they would keep pairing them up in different situations. Okay. So the show itself, the opening scene takes place in Colonel Potter's office, and we are immediately thrown into one of the B plots, which Kevin referred to earlier, which is that Klinger is in his Class A uniform. And he's saluting and he's doing, yes, sir. Blah, blah. And of course, Potter is like, what the hell is going on? Because, you know, he's like, he even says, Class A's, you're out of uniform, no dress, you're out of uniform. And Klinger explains the scam is that he is going to apply to West Point. That, and so he is, of course, becoming the greatest soldier in history by, you know, pretending to be this way. And that, so that is the initial scam. And we've talked about this in previous episodes. I love, one of the things I love so much about Harry Morgan as Colonel Potter, it's a long list, is Colonel Potter's delight when he learns of this plot, because he just loves the scam. He knows it's not, you know, we all know it's not going to work, maybe, but he loves the entertainment, and that it, like, he's letting Klinger be Klinger. He realizes how to handle all of these people, how hard you got to ride some of these people, others not so much. And I love that he enjoys allowing Klinger the room to be Klinger. You know, he's like, okay, you're going to just go through this plot. And the look of delight on Harry Morgan's face is palpable. And I love this opening scene because it just sets it up like, okay. And then they set up the main plot, which is we're talking about the changing of the script. They get a phone call saying the script is going to be changed and you have to help out with that because we got to make sure that the security is detailed. So right in the first scene, we've got A and B plots happening, which is terrific. It's just a great way to start the show.
Where's Radar? He's not in this episode.
He's
not mentioned in this episode. Hey, writers, one line of dialogue. There, Klinger, get this taken care of. Radar is not going to be back from Tokyo R&R for another 3 more days. Yeah. One line of dialogue, guys. Go ahead, Chuck.
I've been watching the episodes as we've been going along. Radar is missing in quite a few episodes in the first part of the season anyway, and they just don't mention him. I wonder if Gary Berghoff had that in his contract.
He mentioned in an interview actually in the Complete Book of MASH by Susie Coulter, which was as a kid it was the main book of MASH that I own. It was my Bible. I learned so much about it. Was that he felt burnt out playing the part, and he worked into his contract that he could take off for various episodes. And so that's why he's not in a lot of them. And he's missing in some in season 4. He's missing in a few more in season 5, and he's missing even more in season 6. Again, I love the recurring breaking of continuity that when Klinger takes over for Radar and he has no idea how to be a company clerk, it's like he's been filling in for Radar a lot. Like, does Klinger have no memory? I mean, I don't understand what's happening here.
I also Sherman Potter calls the guy who's calling him up Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And I love when we get these tiny references. I love when Colonel Potter is familiar with other characters who we don't know or have never seen before, because it builds up that back mythology for the young Sherman Potter Chronicles that we're all eagerly awaiting. It just little drops of pre-existing continuity just warm my heart. It's like, he's got a real rich life. He really did exist prior to, stepping off that Jeep in episode 1.
Disney Plus needs content. So, and Hulu needs content. So come on, Disney. I'm not big on prequels, and I'm not big on requels and all these sidequels and all these things. But if they want to do the Sherman Potter Chronicles, I will watch that show. I will even cancel my subscription and start it over again when that show comes on, just so they know that's why I'm back on it. So, anyway, so now we've set up two of the three of the plots of this episode. We go to post-op and we see Hawkeye is working on a patient. The patient is played by an actor named Tom Deaver. Tom Deaver has been in like 6 episodes of MASH to this point, and he is always playing an MP or some soldier. His most famous role is probably the MP in Welcome to Korea. He's the one who stops Hawkeye and Radar on the way to the airport. And they go through that whole bit about the disease, and he lets Radar go through, but he's going to have to bite his elbow and whatever, all this crazy stuff. He's that guy. So he's been in like half a dozen MASH episodes. And then the other character that we meet is a friend of this guy's, and this character's named Sergeant Maxwell. He's played by an actor named Glenn Ash, who passed away in 2018. He had a bunch of TV credits like Heart to Heart, Laugh-In, Gomer Pyle, so he's used to wearing uniforms. And he shows up to talk to his friend Boone. That's the character's name that Tom Deaver's playing. Now, remember that name, because it's going to kind of come into play later on in the episode. But anyway, they set up this whole idea that the script is going to be changed, and Boone has a bunch of money he wants to change, but he is laid up and he can't do it. And so he asks the sergeant, can you do it for me? And the sergeant's like, I can't. I'm going to be kind of be running security. So then Hawkeye volunteers to change the script for him, which again will become, and now we're in plot 3 of this episode, and that's going to come a cropper later on. But that's the initial setup of this, is the whole idea of the army script. Now, before this episode, for you guys that ever seen this one, and I'll start with you, Chuck, had you ever heard of this concept of army script? I never knew about it until I didn't know that that was a thing until I've seen this episode.
No, I never thought about it. It never occurred to me. They've bought things in past episodes. They've gone to Tokyo and they've bought things that when peddlers have come through. But I honestly never had heard of military script before.
Well, in the episode I did with you a year or so ago, Payday, we see them getting paid in military scrip because it's this weird looking Monopoly money. But I'd never heard of it outside the context of MASH.
You know, you're right. I mean, I can picture the money in my head in Payday, and you're right. It doesn't look like it doesn't. It's not greenbacks. So, but I mean, I think my brain just kind of script, you know, just like went over like, all right, maybe is that like prop money or something? Is that, or something? You know, I was not a bright child, so I didn't even probably think about it. But yeah, so that's the whole idea of military script. And for anyone understanding why they have that, it's to prevent exactly what's happening. Because that way they can change it on the regular and keep it on the base. It's not meant for civilians. And in fact, in later episodes of the show, they would talk about characters that have actual U.S. currency means it was done on the black market or under the table. Oh. It was ill-gotten gains. That's how you know this was not on the up and up, is if it's actual U.S. money. But the point of the script is to do what they're doing here, is to be able to say, okay, we're going to render these all of this stuff invalid. It's kind of like that bank that just foreclosed over out in California. It's just all of a sudden it's worth nothing. So that is the idea of this episode. But I mean, I'd never heard that before until I saw this episode. So I'm like, okay, I'm learning stuff about how it works out in the military. Yeah.
The guy who plays Sergeant Maxwell is just so natural. I love him. Hawkeye does a little joke and Sergeant Maxwell just sort of half smiles at the roadblock. Later on, he's like, oh, Charles is getting busted in. He's like, oh, just trying to be helpful, sir. He sounds like Tom Baudette from the Motel 6.
I just leave the light on for you.
Lily the light on for you. He just sounds so natural. And did you say he was in some Gomer Pyle?
Yes.
Yeah.
He had a ton of TV credits. I just picked a couple, but yeah, he had virtually no movies. It's all just, you know, one episode of this, two episodes of that. Every TV show from the late 60s through 70s to early 80s, he had at least one episode in. That was what TV careers were like back then. You know, you could just keep going. Side note, I would love to have read a book interviewing these kinds of guys.
Right.
Because I want to know what their life was like. Like, were they wealthy? Like, what was their version of wealth? I mean, I would imagine it's kind of the best of both worlds. I mean, probably you're probably constantly struggling to find the next gig as opposed to being a regular. But you look at a guy like, again, like Glenn Ash, who had like 100 credits. He was always working. He's always working. Adam 12, policewoman. And I wonder, like, that probably seems like a cool life because you have none of the downside of the fame, but you get the money, you know, and he's always working. So, yeah, I'd love to hear about these. I know they, you know, they don't do that as much nowadays because they know that nerds like us are watching these shows with a jeweler's loop kind of thing, and they don't recast. You know, you don't recast anybody nowadays. You pick one actor, that's it.
That's right.
But Tom Deaver could play six different sergeants on MASH, right. And they figured nobody's paying attention. Nobody cares that is the same guy that he was in Aid Station and Welcome to Korea, and you know they didn't care. But
there is a documentary, and I'm blanking on the name. It's called something like I Know That Face or That Guy in where they interview actors, and then there's one for actresses, and basically they consider themselves, from what I remember, like kind of working jobbing actors. Sure. You know, like one day you're a cop here and the next day you're a lawyer on Dallas, and it's it's a job, and they're regular suburban people, but they're not the stars, you know.
Right.
I've probably seen those actors in different things hundreds of times and never paid really any attention to them.
None of the pressure of carrying the show, you know. I mean, he said, as you say, Kevin, like Glenn Ash as Sergeant Maxwell, he's effortless. Like, you know, I mean, you don't notice him and you're not meant to. Like, he's just, oh yeah, I totally bet that's the sergeant. And the show just rolls on, you know. Speaking of character actors, in the next scene, we are in the swamp with Winchester and his tailor, Mr. Kim, played by Philip Ahn, who was in like another dozen episodes of MASH, again, always playing a Korean villager of some sort. Here again, he is the tailor. And this is the beginning of where you're like, Winchester's a real dick in this episode because he won't pay Mr. Kim for the work that he did, his suit. And Mr. Kim can smell a rat and he starts doing this bit where he's like $33. And then they keep talking $32, $31, $28. He keeps lowering his price, trying to get Winchester to pay for him. And Winchester flat out stiffs him.
Right.
He says, he doesn't say I'm not going to pay you, but the inference is, no, you're not getting paid because I want you to help me with this idea that I have. And it's like, that is really rotten. That's rotten not to pay anybody. As a freelance illustrator, I spent more time than I cared to chasing down payments for work that I had already done, which was awful, let alone this guy who is struggling to survive on the margins of war-torn Korea, and Winchester is doing that. And even Mr. Kim even says, you rich American. He said, literally says that. And I love that line because he's like, what? Why are you like this? It's a terrific scene.
And I looked up this actor, Philip Ahn, because I know I've seen him.
Yep.
But according to Wikipedia, he was the first Korean American actor to get a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He is considered one of the preeminent Asian American actors in early television and movies. He was going back, I think they said, to the 30s and 40s. So he really is a well-respected actor that, again, I hadn't really considered too much before.
Good for him. That's terrific. I didn't know that. That's wonderful. The most famous MASH role I can think of, he is the father in Hawkeye, the episode where it's all just Alan Alda.
Oh.
And he's the father. He's the one who's like, Weijangbu. Like, he doesn't speak any English. He's that guy. But again, you've seen him in a bunch of episodes. But yeah, he's terrific in this. And again, I love that line where he says, like, you're a rich American. Like, just that feeling of like, don't you have something else to do than to worry about this?
He brings a certain dignity to it too. Like, he's not just being steamrolled. He's having to do what he has to do. But he says stuff like, I'm an honest man. You know, I don't make monkey business for my people.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I don't want to do this. You're forcing me to do this.
Yeah, it's terrific. And then the very next scene, he runs into Hawkeye and BJ out on the compound, and he says, he only pay me compliment. I'm sorry, I'm, reading the lines as he's actually the way he said them. And of course, Hawkeye and BJ are instantly disgusted, because they should be, because it's terrible. And even later, you get BJ has the line, this is what this place needs, a robber baron who makes house calls, which is just terrific. And, it immediately becomes, reminiscent of a Hawkeye Trapper episode, where it's like, okay, we have like a caper. There's like a thing that our two main heroes are doing here. And they have to execute this plot, and they didn't do as much of them as the show went on, but it's great to have, kind of BJ in a little more of that Trapper mold, at least for this episode, where it's like, oh, okay, we're going to come up with something to stop this. As they say, sink that fink is the phrase they actually use.
That outdoor scene where they walk out just as they meet Mr. Kim has one of my favorite things that MASH does, and that is where practically every line of dialogue is a twist or a spin on a quote or a title or something like that. BJ comes out and says, oh, Mr. Kim of Hart Schaffner and Kim, with Hart Schaffner and Marks was the gentleman's clothing store. He says he's working for Mr. Winchester. He says, oh, adding to the Winchester wardrobe. Winchester is a type of, wardrobe, as in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that sort of thing. And then after Charles leaves, BJ's like, oh, fool and his money have just departed. I love that snappy, twisty dialogue. In an earlier episode, Hawkeye does a lot of that, and Margaret says, like, why do you talk that way?
Right.
Hawkeye says, I grew up in a movie theater. It's like everything I saw was like, movie quotes and stuff like that. But I love when MASH does, it's the only show I can think of that does that with such rapidity. Like, almost every line is a twist and a spin on something. It's very part of the cleverness of MASH.
I didn't realize those were like real tailors or real. I'd never heard of that. The names that he spits out. I just never understood the reference, but those were real tailors.
Wasn't that? Yeah. Hart Schaffner and Marks was a gentleman's clothing store. I thought it was on the East Coast.
It may have been
in the 50s.
Kevin, I'm not that old.
That movie. I'm sorry. I'm blanking. Oh, 1, 2, 3, the Jimmy Cagney movie. I think they're referenced in that with those three guys.
Oh, okay.
But I can't be wrong. It's been a long time.
There's a whole big thing in that movie about buying suits. Okay. I will have to check out. Oh God. Well, now I have an excuse to watch 1, 2, 3 again, which I don't really need. So, that's true. Okay. Awesome. Great. All right. That's cool. I'm glad to know. So, then we follow Hawkeye and BJ into post-op, and they talk to Sergeant Maxwell. And that's where this is where the other plot kicks in, where they ask Maxwell, can you do us a favor? Which obviously is going to involve stopping Winchester. Maxwell says, well, I can't. I have to exchange Boone's money. And Hawkeye says, well, if you do, he says, we'll exchange favors. If you do our favor, we'll do you yours. And they say, is that okay? And Boone's like, sure, I trusted this guy with my life. Absolutely. So let's go ahead. So, okay, we've got our plot rolling. And then we go to the mess tent and we have Father Mulcahy talking to Margaret. And she pulls money out of her pocket and she says, this is money I owe you from the poker game. And there's this weird little angle where Mulcahy accidentally thinks there's $10 missing and he realizes that two of the bills have stuck together. And it's awkward. I think maybe we've all had that situation where someone owes you money and you're like, it's not exactly what, like, do I bring this up? Do I not? This is such a niggling detail that only because I'm doing the show that I think about this stuff, right? Hawkeye and BJ come in and sit down and Mulcahy's got the money. And there's this conversation about, oh, like, what, you know, what's this money about? And they mentioned that this was in a poker game. It would never occur to me that Mulcahy and Margaret are in a poker game separate from anything Hawkeye and BJ do. It never occurred to me before.
And they could not have done that scene just a couple of seasons earlier. Margaret is not that the Hot Lips would not do that. She wouldn't be playing poker with the priest.
Exactly. Exactly. I was like, wait, there are other poker games that go outside of, which I was like, of course there are. We know that, you know, there's all sorts of activity going on, especially with the enlisted, but there's
they're playing with the fourth doctor. They're playing with,
exactly. They're playing with the brain surgeon. They're playing with Spear Chucker, who's still here somewhere. We just don't see him. But I mean, you know what I mean? Like it literally, I was like, oh, I guess. Okay. Hawkeye and BJ weren't invited to that one. I guess such a weird thing to even think about, but that's what happens when you've seen these shows 10,000 times, you know. Do either of you, Kevin, let me start with you. Do either of you play poker? Have you done it in any sort of context?
No, regularly or years, not at all? All of these years, I still can't play craps. I still can't play poker. Watching these shows and you figure I'd pick up something. No, I don't.
If it involves any kind of sporting activity or game, I stink. So I played checkers, but beyond that, I'm a bad sport, so I can't play any games with anybody. I'll tip over the Monopoly board. So
I don't believe that for a moment. So Potter shows up with a letter and he has this great line where he makes a joke and he says, you know, Hawkeye says, he's like, Potter brings up this thing. Like, hey, I've got some news. It's really not that big of a deal. And Hawkeye says, well, then let's not even talk about it. He's sort of dismissing Potter. And then Potter has a thing. He says, you know, Pierce, you can be very, sometimes you can be very funny. And then there's now, which is
one of my favorite deliveries of all time.
You can be very amusing. He says, and then there's now.
Switch is just fantastic. It's just deadpan.
He's got to, once in a while, you got to, you know, put Hawkeye down just a little bit. Like, all right, calm down. All right. So anyway, Potter mentions that this is an entrance examination to West Point for Maxwell Q. Klinger. And everyone is absolutely horrified. Margaret is beyond surprised. She's actually offended at this notion because this is the same school that produced, as she puts it, my Donald
is and going MacArthur.
To, and MacArthur is going to have maybe Klinger show up there, and they realize they have this whole grant. And it's BJ who figures out the angle immediately, where he says that that brilliant screwball finally did it. He's getting out of the service by joining the army, which is, I have no idea whether there is any validity to that. Like, would they let you do that?
Okay, but shall we talk about how you actually get into West Point?
Sure.
Chuck, you happen to know? I mean, a couple of.
Absolutely not.
Okay. No, so this is, so first of all, you have to be between the ages of 17 and 22.
Oh.
So I don't know how old Klinger is supposed to be. Jamie Farr was in his mid 40s. I always bought Gary Berkoff as, you know, I'm still maybe 19 year old, but I don't think Klinger qualifies in terms of age. So what happens is you have to be nominated by a member of Congress or the Vice President of the United States, who I guess acts in her capacity as...
Holy, wow!
As President of the Senate. So now this is a lot harder in a state with like one congressman, but in like New York or California, it's a little easier. And it really, it can be anything from, you know, you having a connection to, you know, you being an Eagle Scout and getting a couple of letters of recommendation sent to your congressman saying, hey, this guy is really good. So you have to have the grade. You have to have the grades, which I don't think Klinger has. But you, the primary point is, yeah, so when he says Uncle Gus calls a congressman, you know, the congressman nominated Klinger. I don't know why he would want to use up, you know, his like handful of slots he's allowed to nominate. Well, you know, Uncle Gus maybe has, you know, a few, you know, knows where the congressman's bones are buried or something like that. So you have to be nominated by a member of Congress. You have to be the right age. At that point, you had to be male.
They mentioned that no women at West Point at this
time. And Margaret will say, isn't it, you know, maybe someday women will be allowed in, which led me down my own little rabbit hole. So those listeners of a certain age, this program may recall a TV show called Real People.
And
for those of you who don't, it was basically a human interest show about real people doing interesting things. And if you go on YouTube and you want to type in Real People First Female West Point Cadets, what you'll get is about a 6 or 7 minute interview done. I think women were allowed in 76. This was like 79 or 80. And it's with one of the first women who was in the first female class at West Point, who's now commander of cadets. She really rose up really fast, really high. And so it's the same sort of thing you would expect. It's, you know, sort of, you get to see nice shots of West Point. You get to see some of the women who are cadets there. Sarah Purcell, who is kind of a fluffy interviewer, think, you know, Corky Sherwood from Murphy Brown, basically does the sort of stuff you would expect. She's like, oh, that, you know, 10 men for every woman here. The odds are pretty good for you. And of course, as a proper cadet, the woman she's interviewing is like, you know, I'm not here for dating. I'm here to learn to be a leader. I'm here for the next generation of the American military and things like that. So if you've got 7 or 8 minutes, go on YouTube, watch that. It's really entertaining and really interesting. And of course, when you get out of West Point, you have a bachelor's degree. And you are commissioned as a second lieutenant, the lowest level of commissioned officer. But it's a start. It's better than being a dog face.
Wow. Okay. I had no idea it was that hard to get recommended. I mean, they do mention there is the runabout where they suss out when Klinger shows up. I love what he says. Finally, to be a plebe. He's already got the language down. He's like assuming the sale. You know, he's already like. And he's like, you know, when do I pack, sir? Barr's like, he gotta take the damn test first. And then, of course, again, it's BJ who figures it out the second time where he says, wait a minute, this is how it's gonna work. First exam, he cheats, they catch him, they throw him out, and he's free. And, right. And I love how disgusted Hawkeye looks when he hears it, like, oh, come on, that's the point. There's no way that could work. Right?
There's no way. I imagine having already been in the army. First of all, I imagine that would preclude him from actually joining West Point, but they'd probably put him in some sort of stockade or something like that. You can't just breeze on out. Yeah.
Like, I don't think they just, you know, as a reward for cheating, they just kick you out on the street. All right. I guess you're free to go home. Go back to Toledo with Tony Paco. Like, it's not going to work that way, for God's sake. But so again, we've got this set up with this plot that he's got to take this big test to get involved. At West Point. So then we see Zale show up and talk to, well, Igor.
Right.
But for the second and last time, Igor, played by Peter Riegert, who, of course, most famously played Boone in Animal House. So here we've got Boone from Animal House in an episode with another character named Boone. It's got to be a complete coincidence. This episode aired before Animal House ever came out, so it's not like they, you know, like he had done the role before this, but it is just weird to see, you know, like that's not Igor, that's not the Igor we know. And it seems like for this episode and the War of Nerves, which he appeared in, Peter Riegert appeared in as Igor, they seem to be transposing the relationship Klinger and Zale have to Igor and Zale, because there's this whole bit about where Zale owes Boone, or excuse me, Igor. I did it right there. Zale owes Igor money, gives him the money, and Igor's like, "Hey, that's you owe me more than that," and it immediately launches into a giant fight, like it's hair trigger. And that was the kind of relationship Klinger and Zale had, where it's like these, you can't put these guys anywhere near each other, and so it's interesting that previously, we never saw Igor or Zale really have anything to do with one another outside of just being the corpsman. But in their two episodes together, they're ready to beat the crap out of each other, or at least get really annoyed at one another. So it's interesting that they chose to give that characterization to this version of Igor, who, of course, we will never see again.
Are we supposed to assume this is the Igor that we know, or just another guy in camp with the same name? On television, you never have two people with the same name. So I've got a grandfather, a brother, a cousin, and a nephew who are all Michael V. Coletta. So there's, I wonder if he's supposed to be the same Igor. I don't know. I didn't think about that.
I think the odds that there would be two Igors in Korea seem pretty remote to me. We never do see this Igor doing any of the stuff that we're familiar with Jeff Maxwell's Igor doing, like being a cook, cutting potatoes. Like, we always just see him as this kind of a generic corpsman. So that had never occurred to me that they might be suggesting it's a different Igor. I always look at how many Igors can you possibly have in the Weijambu, Korea.
And it's funny that you mention he had just filmed or was about to film Animal House, because Johnny Hamer, who played Zale, had probably his biggest movie role that year in 77. He's in Annie Hall.
Yes.
Won Best Picture. He plays that terrible comedian.
Oh, he's so funny.
Which is cringing, but I always liked Zale when he showed up on the show.
It's great. I love him in Annie Hall. He's so funny in Annie Hall. He's terrific. Igor responds by shoving food in Zale's face, and Zale yells, "I'll kill him!" And it immediately descends into a fight outside of the mess tent. It's kind of amazing to get into a fight right in front of Colonel Potter. That doesn't seem like the smartest idea in the world. Okay. So they're beating the crap out of each other, sort of. It's a very sort of namby-pamby kind of fight. They're really just wrestling around on the ground. Hawkeye and BJ separate them, and Potter says, you two are, basically restricted. And Igor says, "But sir, I'm going on R&R. And Potter's like, "Do you want to try for double or nothing?" He's like, "No, sir." Okay. And then they send them off to cool down. Hawkeye realizes that he's left Boone's money in the mess tent, and he runs back to grab it. And of course, the money is gone. We never learned who did it, but man, whoever did it was really sharp. They were only out of the mess tent for about 10 seconds. And it's not like Hawkeye was walking around with a bag with a giant dollar sign on it. So man, how quickly did you? They ran it was like that time that Hawkeye and Trapper went to Tokyo, and they come out and the Jeep is already taken apart. It was like a pit crew. Was there somebody in the mess tent following Hawkeye around and just waiting in case he left the money? That's pretty sharp.
Well, maybe it was radar. We didn't see him this episode. Maybe he was lurking somewhere.
How dare you say that about Ray? What's the matter with you? So that is the act break. And of course, Hawkeye is, beside himself because he realizes he's lost someone else's money. So then we come back in act two, and we're in the swamp, and Hawkeye is desperate to borrow money from Winchester to help pay off this guy's debt. And Winchester is having absolutely none of it. And he's just being absolutely a total jerk about it. And there's this great bit where BJ even says, he wouldn't even take your money if you got down on your hands and knees. And Hawkeye's like, "Wait, let me try me. Hold on. Whatever. Not so fast." But Winchester just leaves Hawkeye twisting in the wind, unfortunately. So again, he's just being a complete jerk about all of this. And poor Hawkeye is like, "What the hell am I? The hell am I going to do?" And he doesn't even figure out, where is he going to come up with $400?
$4,000.
$4,000. Yeah, right. Imagine, exactly.
I mean, $400 was a lot of money in the 50s. It was a lot of money in the 70s. It's a lot of money now. I can't imagine playing, I guess he's playing craps. He's just like six straight passes and pocketing $4,000. But then I'm not a gambler, so I don't know. But that seems like a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad. So that's the formula, Kevin. You just add a zero to it.
Basically, add a zero. Yeah.
Okay, because I've been wasting time doing math all the time in these episodes.
It averages in and out. I mean, did you run some numbers? You have slight. I'm sure whatever you got is very close.
No, I didn't do it for this one, but in previous episodes, I've just been doing the calculations. I didn't realize it's so much easier just to add a zero. Okay,
so the nebulous 1950s to more or less now basically add a zero. So
okay, good to know. So Hawkeye then goes into post-op, breaks it to Boone what's happened, and he says the bag is gone. And immediately Boone says, "I'm out 400. And Hawkeye says, "No, I'm out 400. I'll wire my father and have it for you a couple of days." And Boone is having none of it. Boone even says, I've seen bigger scams and from higher officers than you. So he just completely doesn't trust Hawkeye. He thinks the whole thing is a scam. And, you know, I mean, you could understand that. This is not a guy that he knows. But if it's like, if it's a scam, it's a bad scam. You know what I mean? Like, there's no cleverness to this. It's just, if you think that the guy's just saying, I guess I just stole your money. Like, oh, well, that's really the whole, like, that's it. But okay. You know, again, as he says, I'm an MP. He's obviously dealt with, you know, some rough people. So he doesn't trust Hawkeye. So I will mention this, just because it's timely in the talking of scams. I'm a little ashamed to admit this. I came very close to falling for a scam just recently. There is an online scam going on involving freelance illustrators where someone offers you a, maybe you guys have heard of this scam, where someone will offer you money for a particular service. They will then send you a check or an electronic payment. That payment takes a couple of days to process. Before that money gets processed, the original person will say, oh, hey, part of this job I hired you for has been canceled. I need half the money back and I need it back immediately. And then, yes. And then the target, the said pigeon, thinking, well, I've got, for instance, $8,000 coming to me. They need 4,000 of it back. I'll give them the 4,000 now. They do that. And then a couple of days later, you find that the check that you got in the first place has bounced. Ooh. That was perpetrated on me during the last week since recording the last episode. I did not fall for it, but it went further along than it should have, I guess, because I have an open, trusting face. But yeah. And so that kind of stuff still going on. And in fact, even more so now that we have the lovely internet.
Well, I'll tell you what, that reminds me, I was scammed once, but I kind of triumphed in the end. There was someone selling online supposedly costumes from films.
Ooh.
Nothing famous, but wardrobe from movies. And our most famous alum on campus is Eva Marie Saint. And they were selling a supposed Eva Marie Saint dress that she had worn in some minor movie. And so I bought it for a few $100s. I said, I'll donate it to the library. And then I sent Miss Saint, who I know a little bit, a picture of the dress, saying, could you please tell me where you wore this or what show you wore this? I never wore that dress. I would never wear that dress. it's terrible. You know, what happened? Where is this going on? I am going to write the Academy and get this guy. And so she got me my money back. So,
wow.
I was able to prove that, hey, no, she did not wear this dress. It was not her color.
I'm a winter.
So that was it, basically it. So thank God for Eva Marie Saint, who got me my $300 back. But I have been fooled. I have been fooled.
That's amazing, though. How many people can get to say legendary actress Eva Marie Saint? Help me get out of a scam. That's
because
good,
all the other actresses were dead. It was like, you know, Tallulah Bankhead's dress. I said, well, I know her, maybe, you know, but no, thank God. You know, I did get, and a few years after that, she said, did you ever get your money back? I said, oh, yes, thank you very much. So,
you know, Chuck, you should write that up. I think there's like an Academy magazine. I don't know if you have to be a member of the Academy, but I bet you, do you have like any pictures or anything like that? Do you have?
I'd have to look. I did take a picture of the dress, and she was horrified by it. It was like this. It was like something that somebody would have worn on the Little House on the Prairie. And I probably should have known better, but it was like, well, $300, I'll buy it, I'll donate it. But hey.
Write that up. See if you can get it published in the Academy magazine or something like that.
Oh, I will.
Investigate. That'd be a great story.
Yeah.
Or even just your local paper or something.
That is amazing. I love that, like, you know, her offense came from that it was ugly, like she would wear it. You know what I mean? Like, not even like on a factual, like, I didn't wear it. No, I would never wear that ugly dress. That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. I have to admit, I was a little ashamed that I let this go on as long as I did. In my defense, I've had clients before, that had lots of money to spend and were pretty incompetent. So it doesn't, just because you have a lot of money doesn't mean you aren't an idiot. I mean, we're all living with examples of that right now. But yeah, I overrode my own sense of reason on numerous occasions because I wanted the money and it seemed like an easy gig. And I was like, well, all right. And then it became, and then when I did some reading and someone said, well, here's the trigger. The trigger will be before you actually have the money on hand, they will ask you for partly of a refund. And that's exactly what this person did. He said, oh, well, I know you've got the money, so we need half of it back now. And I said, well, I don't have the money. Your check is still pending. And they said, well, no, we consider you having the money, so you have to send us the refund. And that was the point where I said, no, I'm not doing that. And that's the end of this transaction. So, but it's still going on. 2023, still going on.
MashCast, folks. MashCast, not just for yucks. You learn something. If you're not careful, you may learn something before it's done.
There you go. Right. There you go. Thank you. So, so anyway, Boone is, you know, disgustedly tells Hawkeye basically kiss off. And Hawkeye, of course, is offended for his own honor. And he says, look, whether you believe me or not, you'll get your money. Mulcahy shows up having heard about the theft, absolutely furious, and gets on the radio and does a marvelous fire and brimstone speech, condemning the theft. He says it's an abomination before the Lord and a really dirty trick. And just because vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. It's basically almost the same speech in tone that Samuel L. Jackson gives in Pulp Fiction when he's about to shoot those guys. It's the same idea. And I love how red-faced William Christopher gets. Like, he gets completely beat red to the point, and he gets so carried away, Hawkeye has to grab the microphone and pull it away. And Mulcahy's like, do you think that'll work? And Hawkeye says, anyone who didn't hear that, it means they're deaf. It's marvelous turn William Christopher.
Hawkeye has to stop him with, yes, folks, a Jack Benny reference. I'm not just here for my pretty face. Hawkeye says, we're a little late, folks, so good night. Which is how some episodes of the Jack Benny show would end, because it would go a little bit long. If somebody had like an ad lib and somebody else spun off on that ad lib, you could lose 30 seconds of your script. You could lose 45 seconds of your script. Sometimes at the very end, there wouldn't be time to do the button joke. Like when episodes of MASH are in syndication, sometimes they got to lop off, you know, those last 30 to 45 seconds. Mm-hmm. You would just do your Jell-O commercial. Always make sure you get your Jell-O commercial in there, and you just cut the Jack Benny. We're a little late, folks, so good night.
I had no idea that that was even a reference to anything. I mean, it sounds like a phrase, but I certainly didn't know what it was. But I should have known that if it's Jack Benny, you would
Yep.
Then we have Winchester out in the outside the base in his Jeep, and he's exchanging the money. And again, he's giving everybody basically 10 cents on the dollar. And we see some other actors that we've seen on MASH before. And there is this one little moment, which kind of going back to what you mentioned at the top of the show, Chuck, where you feel like this is a Frank Burns story, is because they're saying, thank you. Thank you. He's like, thank you, right, gentlemen. And then there's this moment where they all bow. And he says, now you may bow. And they do it. And he says, thank you. And he mutters to himself, why can't they just shake hands like everybody else? That's kind of an ugly joke. You know, it's not the worst thing I've ever heard, but it's pretty insensitive. It's pretty culturally insensitive. And it's just not something you would ever hear out of Winchester before or since, but it's definitely something you could imagine Frank Burns saying.
Right. And you know, that's what these are characters. These aren't people. And he's only played him for a handful of episodes. And so they're still trying to find the way. You know, they didn't know where he was going. I'm sure they had a blueprint, but okay, this doesn't work. Okay, so now we forget it. And now we're going to focus on class more than sort of cultural stuff with him.
Yeah, it feels just very out of place for Winchester. And again, they wouldn't ever repeat it. So he drives off, and now we are back with Klinger as he's about to take the West Point exam, being proctored by Potter and BJ, which is kind of nice that BJ gets his own little kind of thing to do here. Now, this test that they make Klinger undergo, they say he has, I think, 3 hours, they say, to complete this. Yeah, 3 hours to complete the questions, right? And some of the questions that Klinger has to answer maybe because I'm uneducated in this regard, and so it seems harder to me than maybe it might be if you're getting into West Point. But I love that the first question is like Mary and her kids and the cans of beans. It's like remedial level difficulty. You know, it's like the SATs.
It starts off easy and gets up smaller.
Right. So then and of course, Klinger immediately has trouble with it. He gets flustered right at the beginning. And then, you know, we see that obviously Klinger has not prepared for this at all. Now, I want to ask you guys both this as well. Test wise, how well do you test? I mean, it's probably both of you. It's been a long time since you've taken tests. Chuck, I'm sure you give them all the time. But how well do you, were you good test takers or not so well or what? Kevin, what about you?
I was a pretty good test taker. Unlike Klinger, I don't slowly like start to undress as the test progresses. Klinger gets worse and worse. He starts off perfectly and his tie's a little bit looser. And it's like he's totally open chested and he's sweating. He's doing a horrible job. And for those of you at home, boy, check out Jamie Farr's sideburns. Those are some seriously thick sideburns. I tested pretty good. I ended up getting 2 master's degrees. So I did okay. I will never forget one, as long as we're telling some personal stories here. I had to take the GRE, Graduate Record Exam in English Lit. And I only remember one specific question because I had no idea. The English Lit one tests all sorts of knowledge across all sorts of literature. And it was the same line from the Bible, but in like 5 different versions. It's like, okay, which of these is the King James? Which is the Revised Standard? Oh. Which is the New International? And it's like, I had no idea. That's the one question I specifically remember from the GRE. I'm sure I did not get it right. It's like, wow, you really got to know your stuff.
I'm a heathen. I would never know that, which version of the Bible. Oh my God.
Yeah, you know, that sounds very difficult.
I took a lot of tests. I was okay, but I would bomb this one. Any of these math word problems. I took one class. I was an English major and got a master's in English. I took a class that was math for English majors where we read about math. We didn't have to do any math. We just read about people who were good at math. And I do remember a time in high school or junior high, I was taking some algebra test and I had a panic attack and I walked up to the teacher and I said, I'm freaking out. I can't take. So he had pity on me and I let me come back and take it later. But it's much what I tell my students. It's much easier to give a test than to take it. So I understand. I've sat where you are and don't panic. I once had a student. I'll just do this real quick. I once had a student who was taking the final exam and he turned in his test. He was as white as a ghost. He was sweating. He was so nervous. He was shaking. And the reason why he was so nervous is the exam was on a Friday. He was graduating from college on Saturday and getting married that Sunday.
Whoa!
And so everything hinged on this grade. And he doesn't know this. I don't remember his name. This is many years ago. But he passed my class, the test, by 1 point. And I would have given it to him anyway, because I'm not going to ruin this guy's life. You know, my Archie dumped me and I didn't graduate college because I forgot that question about, you know, Beverly Hillbillies in that popular culture class.
Cement pond. You wrote down right. Cement ocean, you idiot.
So you left out the H in Jethro, you know. Oh my boy, what a way to put the whammy on yourself.
Right.
You know, my anything else? What did he have scheduled for Monday? You know, like what the holy geez. Yeah. Test wise, there's a reason I went to art school. Let's just leave it at that. Winchester is headed back to camp and he is stopped by Sergeant Maxwell, who tells him that nope, the base is basically, the road is closed at this point. It's an access road and you're going to have to go a different way. Winchester argues with him and Maxwell is not having it. And I don't know if you guys, either one of you know the answer to this. I've always been sort of curious as to how this kind of authority works, in that obviously in most situations, a major has the final word over a sergeant. But when you're an MP, the MPs have to have some authority above ranks that they would normally have to answer to, because otherwise the MPs have no authority. So I'm guessing that in these instances, the MP's word is final, kind of like a doctor on a ship, you know, kind of like a Dr. McCoy kind of thing, where he's the only one that could say, you know, Captain Kirk, you need to stand down. It's that kind of thing, because you've got Winchester saying, you have to let me through. And Maxwell is like, no, I don't have to. You might. And he's even a little smart ass about it. He's like, well, you better run, sir. So I'm guessing, I mean, do you want to know how that works? It's like, I guess in certain circumstances, the MP's word is final.
I imagine so. But plus, he does say, he says the road's been mined.
Right.
So he's not just saying, no, I'm not going to let you go because I don't like your face. It's like, you can't go that way. You're going to blow yourself and the Jeep up. But I love this. Again, I love this so natural delivery of just trying to be helpful, sir.
He's got that kind of like shit-eating grin sort of thing going on. So then we get back to the test. And the questions have gotten a bit harder because now describe the political changes that happened as a result of Napoleon's defeat at the Battle of Waterloo. Now, how long would that take to write out? How can you possibly get to that in 3 hours? Like, they all of a sudden, like, the curve on this test went from 0 to 60 in just a couple of minutes. Like, oh my God. Can they possibly expect anyone to have that level of answer? Just, I mean, how many paragraphs do you have to get into, you know, to be able to know all this?
I could not answer that question now.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I know he lost, but I mean, I don't know.
The soldiers went home. That's one of his answers. Right. Like, that was the result.
And Amber wrote that song. So
that's right. Yeah. So we're cutting back to Winchester, and he is, of course, trying to run back to the 477. He runs by a Korean washwoman with a cart. This is the same actress that played the woman who cleaned the swamp when he moved into the swamp in Fade Out, Fade In. She's the one who goes, finish. That's right. The same actress here. And he asks for directions, and he gives her a little bit of money. He says, thank you for your trouble. And he takes off. Then we're back to the test. Klinger is sweating profusely. As you mentioned, Kevin, his shirt is open. He's, you know, and he mentions these physical similarities that have been noted between the Eskimos of the Arctic and Mayan Indians of the Southern Hemisphere. Give three theories for this phenomenon.
And I didn't get the joke until I was probably in college. It's like, traveling salesman? It's like, oh, that's actually kind of dirty. I didn't get that joke.
It's like, that's 3 hours by itself. Oh. That answer. Like,
and who is grading this test, I wonder? They're going to send it back to West Point.
Yeah, like, was BJ going to know? Like, what is this about? As when I got older and I started appreciating, you know, the making of the show behind the show rather than just the show itself, I am fascinated by when you see a joke construction to where you could tell the writers probably had a million alts. You know, I always find that very funny to me. And so I would love to know how many questions the writers came up with for this test, you know, like they distilled it down to these three. But I would love to know, did they get harder? Were they a little easier? Like just listening to Klinger read that question starts making me break into a sweat. It's just so terrifying.
Speaking of them being graded, Chuck, so I imagine that in reality, it would have been sent back to West Point. Somebody would have gone through it. And I imagine that the professors would have, you know, passed it around. Do you guys ever pass around essays and things like that? Like, read this. This guy is a complete idiot. This is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Well, believe it or not, what we do, I don't do it as much, but there are programs that you can run essays through. And you can see, well, this is 40% from Wikipedia or
YouTube. Oh, wow.
That have been used over and over again. So that is a thing that we've been doing for a long time. And now with this AI, it's becoming even more tricky. We're not sure who's turning in the papers or who's doing the work. But it's difficult because you can't tell. You need some proof. I'll just leave you with one example. It wasn't a test, but it was a written essay. I once had two students turn in the exact same essay word for word in the same class. They were each writing an essay on whatever the topic was. And I said, boy, this one looks familiar. It sounds familiar. I had just read it about 10 minutes earlier. Cheating does go on, unfortunately.
Oh, man. That's amazing. I mentioned earlier, like I said, I went to art school for a reason. I'm not a good test taker. I will mention that I did give I had a test once where I was actually testing to be, it was for a job where I would be placed as a potential freelance graphic designer at different companies, and I went to this company and they had to test your skills. And I know how to use Photoshop. I've been using it for 20 years, but for some reason that day, I just got incredibly nervous. And I'm reading the instructions, and they put a little timer on your desk, which really, like literally a sand dial, you know, and I'm watching the same, or maybe it wasn't a time, I might be exaggerating, but it was something that was measuring time. And the instructions were a little more complicated than I expected. And I started to just panic. And it got so bad that while I was sweating profusely, I managed to scratch a small scab I had on my head from a previous, you know, scrape. And I started to bleed down my forehead.
Oh, man.
And I ran my hand, you know, because, you know, when you get like a cut, you can have that, there's that slight metallic smell that happens. I guess like it's the iron in your blood or whatever. But I ran my hand over my forehead and looking at my fingers, and there's blood mixed with sweat. And I got so freaked out that I got up and walked out. Even though I knew that that was going to end any chance I was going to get any work from these people, I've never had a panic attack like that in my life before or since. I don't know what it was, but there was. So I truly feel for Klinger in this moment. And yeah. And so he begs Potter for help. He says, "Can I get just one thing right?" And Potter's like, "Well, I shouldn't do this, but," and the button on the joke is, "There's only one G in Klinger." So
thank you, sir. I was a little nervous.
That's great. That's marvelous. Marvel's way to get out of the scene. So now we're out on the compound and the money is being exchanged. And
I just want to say, so just before this, yeah, yes. I just want to say, we're reminded several times during the episode, you need to exchange your money. Otherwise, it's going to be worthless. I think that's really important story structure-wise, because again, this is something that we're not, you know, we're all used to the stories of MASH, bad paperwork, somebody needs an operation. The experience of having money in your pocket that is suddenly going to be worthless isn't something a lot of us experience unless, oh, wait, you're me. Because this actually happened to me. Yes, but this is the episode where we're all telling personal stories. And I have just a minute. Several years ago, when the pound was really low against the dollar, I said, okay, I'm going to go buy like $200 worth of pounds, because I know eventually I'm going to go to England, right? I'll just stick them in the safe deposit box and this will be great. You know, I will have made, you know, 10%, 15%, because I'm sure the value will change. Flash forward, 10 years. We're not going to England. We're going to Poland, but we're going to be in Heathrow Airport for 4 or 5 hours, me and my family. So go, great. I'll bring these pounds with me. You know, I'll buy everybody lunch. I'll get some stuff, the duty free. This will be great. We go there. I'm in line at the sandwich shop at Heathrow. I pop down like, you know, a 10 pound note. And the girl says, "I'm sorry, we can't take this. This is the old money." Oh. And I'm like, "The old money? I'm not trying to pass a shilling note. I'm not trying to spend threepence." She says, "Yeah, a couple of years ago, we changed over the money. So now in America, you know, like the 20s got changed over a long time ago. It seems like $100 bills get changed over to mess up the counterfeiters and things like that." So I said, "What do I do?" So I'm looking around. There's a bureau de change at the airport. I go, "Great. I'm in England. It's a British bureau de change." I go over there and I go, "Look, I got like, you know, 200 pounds in 10s and 20s. I understand it's the old money. Let me give them to you. You give me the new money. We'll call it even." He says, "Nope, can't do that." I say, what do I do? He says, "Well, you have a bank account. You can deposit that." Now, fortunately, I have a British friend who has a bank account. She grew up there. She goes to England every summer to visit her family. And you know, I came home. I gave her the money. I said, "Look, I don't care anymore. If I don't care if I made 10% or whatever, just next time you go, please just deposit this in your bank account. Just give me roughly the American dollar equivalent when you get back. Whatever. My days as an arbitrageur are over." She comes back, she gives me the money and says, "Let me tell you what happened. I went to my bank, I put the money down, I said, 'Hi, I just want to deposit this.' And the girl behind the counter said, 'This is the old money.' And I'm like, 'Yes.' So she called the bank manager over. Bank manager said, 'Okay, we can deposit this. It might be a few weeks before it clears. We have to check the serial numbers, and let me take a photocopy of your passport just in case it turns out these are counterfeit.'"
Oh,
so yes, turning over money, lest it be counterfeit, is a real thing. Is Are either of you familiar with the Danny Boyle movie Millions from 2006?
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's on Disney Plus now. It takes place in a slightly fictionalized version of England, where England is turning over to the euro on New Year's Day. And according to the movie, if your money isn't spent or deposited in the bank account on New Year's Day, it will be worthless, which of course is impossible. You know, if you've got 20 pounds in your pocket, you can still, you know, deposit it later on. And in America, when the money gets changed over, I mean, the money's still good. If you take a $20 bill or $100 bill to Safeway, you can still buy a dozen eggs with it, even if it's the old money. Anyway, the movie is about two young British kids who find a sack full of, you know, stolen cash. It's like 200,000 pounds. And in the weeks prior to the changeover on New Year's, so they have to spend their time trying to spend the money before it's quote worthless. It's directed by Danny Boyle. It's really stylish. It's charming. It's a semi-comedy. I recommend it. It's on Disney Plus. It's fun. And it's about getting rid of money before it becomes worthless, even though that wouldn't really happen.
Okay. Interesting. All right. Yeah. I didn't even know that that's what it was about. I do find it curious that when we see everybody, you know, you see the guys with the suitcases and they're getting up on the kind of like the bandstand sort of thing. Which is, I guess, where the USO played in that, you know, season three episode. But we see everybody milling around on the camp, right? And then they make the announcement. And then everybody scrambles to run to, like, they saw everybody setting up. You could have just stood in line as opposed to like, oh, yeah, what are those guys doing? Oh, well, oh, they're the money guys. Let me run over there. Everybody's sort of jumping to get in line. We see Hawkeye come out and he's got $45 of his own money. And he's like, well, I'm going to trade this in, at least give Boone a little bit of a down payment. They're happy about that. They've managed to stop Charles. Charles finally arrives at the edges of the camp where he is stopped by Klinger, who, of course, has since failed the test and has now decided to join the Navy. And he's got a full on Klinger's costumes are like this, you know, it's like the final scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know, he's got a crates full of stuff. And so he has his Navy hat on and he's got his gloves and he's much like he mentioned, but being a plebe, he's immediately buying into the whole language. And he talks about, you know, he's saying, we've got a wonderful chance to beat Army this year, sir. And he will not let Winchester on the base. He absolutely will not let him. And even has brandishing a rifle, for Pete's sakes, but he will not let Winchester on the base because he's like, you can't let anybody on the camp past a certain point. Now, it's not as though the 477th has one entry point.
No.
Like Winchester could just walk 50 feet in another direction. And, you know, but okay, for the purposes of the show, there's one access road to the 477th.
Charles is so incensed. He gets angrier and angrier. And David Ogden Stiers does this thing. He's like staring at Klinger. Like, what are you doing in that? And he twirls his finger. This hat.
Yeah, he's
building up his anger. It's just David Ogden Stiers. He takes it. This is Charles. As we're recording this, I've just listened to the episode, The Winchester Tapes. As I said, that's the one that has the painting of Charles being angry.
Charles, yeah.
Angry Charles. And angry Charles can push comedy to a new height.
Yeah, he's great. And I mean, you got to imagine first of all, his plot is falling apart, but it's falling apart because Klinger's in yet another one of his cosplay roles, you know, which, you know, Klinger is going to shed 5 minutes after this is all over, you know, it's like even that much, you know, it would be bad enough to have an MP saying you're not allowed on the baser, but Klinger being the one that's stopping you, like that's just like insult to injury. So Hawkeye and BJ wander over. And they say, well, you know, we'll do you a favor. We'll exchange your money for you. But then they do the reverse. They give Winchester 10 cents on the dollar, which was the deal that offered the Korean villagers because they want to pay Boone back his money. And of course, Winchester doesn't want to go with that, but he doesn't have any choice. It's either that or nothing. So they make the exchange and they say Boone's going to get his money back. The problem with this is the Korean villagers are still getting stiffed.
That's right.
There's no recompense for the Korean villagers. Boone's getting his money, but that's it. So, okay, you know, like just maybe Hawkeye and BJ could have done something, but I guess they don't exactly know who got stiffed or what, so they have no way to control that. So, but it is kind of unfortunate that the way this all got started is Mr. Kim and the rest of them, and they probably don't get made whole again.
No, they're screwed, and we never find out who stole the money in the first place. I was sort of surprised at that. We didn't. No culprit was seen.
No, it's just some local crumb bum at the 477th. Yeah. And then the act break ends with Winchester with his bag full of now useless money and his case full of money, just smashing it into the ground and walking off frustrated. And so that's the end of our main episode. And then we end the show in post-op again with Hawkeye giving Boone brand new script. And we can even see it's like great new prop money. It's all clean. It doesn't say it looks like Monopoly money if you've never played the game, like right out of the box and stuff. And, you know, Boone, of course, very happy that he apologizes to Hawkeye for doubting him. And then Mulcahy shows up with the money.
Yeah.
And he realizes that whoever did steal it did atone for it and return the money. And for some reason, Hawkeye, I guess they just want to get into it because it's the end scene. They don't have a lot of time to get to it. Hawkeye doesn't explain to Mulcahy where the money Boone has in his hand has come from. And he says, look at this, father, another 400 from another thief, which he's talking about Winchester
right
in this context. But he lets Mulcahy think the money was returned in that same form. And of course, that inspires Mulcahy to say, two atonements with one speech. And he starts falling, you know, and he's just, oh my God, you know, like, oh, this is, maybe I should do this every week. And Hawkeye even says, why don't you take the orphans out to dinner and a show. And it ends with Mulcahy wandering off, talking about generation of vipers and going on and thinking he's going to become, you know, he's going to do like a weekly radio program. And Hawkeye disabuses him. He says, I wonder if thou shouldst. And it ends with Mulcahy saying, well, it was just a suggestion. And that's the end of our episode. That is Change Day. So it's a nice, funny, cute way to end the show. You know, and it's the last time we would have a sort of Winchester as thief plot, which as much as I enjoy this episode, I'm glad they never went back to it.
Right. Well, this was a good episode, and you may want to cut this out. I don't know, when you air this, but I went to the Popular Culture Library, today, and I got the TV guide from that week to see what was playing against MASH that night. And the lineup on CBS was, a show called Mulligan Stew, which I've never heard of. They were also up against, or airing that night, was The Man from Atlantis.
Oh, Patrick Duffy.
And the big TV sort of noteworthy event of that evening was that Happy Days introduced Leather Tuscadero.
Oh.
That's what was going on November 8th, 1977.
Big night for television. Okay. I shamedly, I have to think, as a kid, I probably was watching Happy Days because I remember Leather Tuscadero. I watched MASH, but I was probably watching Happy Days that night. So, okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Mulligan Stew. I haven't even heard of that. I don't even know what that.
It sounds like an Irish family sitcom. It does. Probably what it is.
And there was also another show on that evening. Again, another show I've never heard of called The Fitzpatricks.
Which also sounds like an Irish family.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I'm sure that that character actor, Dick O'Neill, who was on MASH a bunch of times, I'm sure he was a cast member of one of those shows. It seems like he's almost guaranteed. So that's Change Day. Like I said, it's a nice experiment. It's pushing Winchester in a direction he would had heretofore not gone to and would never go again. And I'm glad that they snapped him back and it became a little more of a human character, but it's a fun plot and it's great to see Hawkeye BJ, as I said, being, you know, kind of doing like a caper. And the Klinger plot is masterful. I mean, the Klinger bit is just fantastic. I just, every time he talks about the Eskimos, I just get like, oh my God, this is the most worst thing ever anyone's ever subjected to. So, Chuck, let me start with you. Do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
Oh, I should have thought about this ahead of time. I just like the fact that Winchester got his comeuppance at the end. Now I'm waffling. I think the comedic highlight of the show has got to be Klinger taking the test. Maybe that you spelled Klinger wrong. Maybe that.
It is as someone who has accidentally signed emails Ron Kelly, I appreciate Klinger misspelling his own name sometimes.
I once turned in an essay in an English course, and the author's name was Frank O'Connor. and I'm constantly talking about Frank O'Connor, and I spelled it wrong. I spelled O'Connor wrong. It was either O-R or E-R at the end, and the teacher just circled it in red pen over and over again. So, you
know. At least it wasn't your own name, Chuck. I mean, sakes, God. So, Kevin, what about you?
In the fight between Zale and Igor, Father Mulcahy's trying to break him up, and Zale says, "Leave me alone, Father. I'm going to break the jawbone of an ass," which is a great biblical twist from Samson. But that's a very funny, sophisticated joke. I like that a lot.
Zale knows his Bible quotes.
Yeah,
we never see him at the services, but he knows the Bible at least.
They even mentioned in that fight, "I'm going to break up Ava and Zsa Zsa." I wonder if the Gabors were that known in the early 1950s. I don't know. I should have looked.
That's what I had as my favorite line was Hawkeye says to BJ, you take Zsa Zsa, I'll get Ava. I absolutely love that reference. They were both famous at that point, but I don't know if they were that level famous because, of course, when MASH aired, this is post Green Acres. So Ava was a TV staple, but when the show was set, it's certainly before all that. So yeah, I mean, Zsa Zsa Gabor was in movies and was known, but yeah, I think it's probably a joke a little bit ahead of its time, but it makes me laugh anyway because it's
it's great.
It's a great I'm glad that line resonated with you too because it makes me laugh. It's another one of Hawkeye's pop culture references, which leads, you know, is the kind of thing that led Margaret to ask, like you mentioned in the previous episode, like, why are you like this? You know, it's that kind of big. So I do love that reference. It's you get Tig Zsa Zsa, I'll get Ava.
Can I send this some our listeners to the final episode? Because there is, you just talked about Rob. God, was it, which episode was it where Dr. Winchester touches his nose? Is it War of Nerves?
Yes.
And you said that joke continues on up to the last episode.
Yes.
Which reminded me that during the past 3 years, there was a great MASH rewatch in my family, and we watched them all with the subtitles on. And at minute 57 of the final episode, that is brought up again. And I had in the past never really been able to understand what was being said because the musicians are playing their music so loud. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But when Margaret brings it up again, when I saw in the subtitles exactly what she says, I was blown away. It is insane and fantastic. And so those of you who can't wait for another 5 or 6 more years till we cover that episode, if you liked Charles touching his nose, jump to the final episode, jump to minute 57 and see how Margaret fleshes it out. It's fantastic.
There is some bit I know where she talks about, like, are you in love with your nose? Do you take it out on a date and put it in little dresses or something?
That's exactly this. I never could hear that because I just hear them fighting and I just hear the musicians playing. And when I saw that, it's like, you love your nose. You dress it up in dresses. You take it out on dates. It's like, oh my God, what is she saying? That's something that Hawkeye would say or something like that. Or something.
It's only because, again, I've seen that episode 5,000 times and okay. I had a chance to pay attention to what she was saying on the side. But yeah,
never got the first few times.
He has an absolutely marvelous reign here. So yeah, that my favorite gag is the you take Zsa Zsa, I'll get Ava. So that's Change Day, everybody. It's a really fun episode. Got some great, again, Klinger, you know, one of Jamie Farr's kind of best moments, I'd say, at least this season at the absolute minimum. So, well, guys, Chuck, Kevin, thank you so much for coming back to the show. You know, I always enjoy having you on, talking to you. So thank you both for doing this.
Oh, thank you. Anytime. I love this.
This was a real joy. Thank you. Nice to meet you, Chuck.
You too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love bringing people together. So, Kevin, why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet? Are you still on LiveJournal?
Get your chisels and stones out. And yes, you can chisel me a message at LiveJournal, Kevin Lauderdale, LiveJournal.com. But I'm also on Facebook. I just recently changed my picture. You can see my gray hair now. I have a sort of a steely, I fancy a sort of a Steve Martin-ish look to myself.
I will tell you, my wife loves it. She thinks
does she? What a sweetie she is. go to Rob's page and like find stuff I've commented on or tagged, and that's where you'll find me.
All right, Chuck, what about you?
Well, I'm only on Twitter as Dr. Pop Culture BGSU, and I'm going to take the quick opportunity to mention again from last time I was on back in December, that in September of this year, 2023, we're going to be holding a Spider-Man in Popular Culture conference. Free and open to all academics, scholars, fans, collectors. And come to my Twitter page and we'll send you a link and hopefully we'll see you in September.
Very cool. And of course, actually, if you want to book it up to MASH, Spider-Man does make an appearance in MASH very briefly, completely out of chronology. But in the Novocaine Mutiny, where Burns, God, I can't believe I couldn't recall his name. God, I'm getting old. In the flashback where Burns is going through Radar's comic book collection, we see a copy of The Amazing Spider-Man, even though that book did not exist in 1952. But, you know, we know Radar had a really good subscription service. So anyway, again, guys, thank you so much. This is always a blast. I always look forward to talking to you. And I was glad to be able to have you both on at the same time. So everybody, you want to find back episodes of this show, go to our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to MASHcast on any podcatcher of your choice. We are also on Twitter at MASH477cast. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, please just go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be named checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Daniel Ulrich, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Mike Thomas, Joe Perino, Billy Shulman, Dennis Bailey, Kara Kay, Tim English, Adam Ackerman, Lisa P, Laura Braun, Stefan Van Skyke, and David Mann. Thank you so much. Oh, that is going to do it. We will see you next week. But until then, that is all.
Clinger, how did you pull it off?
It was my Uncle Gus, sir.
That the uncle that got out of World War I is your Aunt Gussie?
Yes, sir. He's good buddies with a certain congressman.
And catered to St. Valentine's Day Massacre?
He's a biggie, sir.